I believe it is fair to say that very, very few Americans have yet heard of the Earth Charter. That will change very, very soon. Both we and our adversaries will see to that. If the advocates of world government have their way, the Earth Charter will be incorporated into the curriculum and the activities of all our elementary schools, our high schools, our colleges, our universities, and into the decision-making processes of businesses and governments at the local, state, and national levels. The stealth campaign to accomplish this is already well underway. The Earth Charter is not a binding treaty like the Kyoto Protocol or the Convention on Biological Diversity, but that is its strength, not its weakness. The Earth Charter has been insidiously crafted to prepare the peoples of the world psychologically, intellectually, and spiritually to accept all of the binding UN treaties aimed at empowering the United Nations with legislative, judicial, executive, military, and police powers, and to transform it into an all-powerful world government. This is the Earth Charter. This is the copy as produced by the Earth Charter Initiative, the primary organization that is pushing its adoption. It is a mere 2,400 words. It is a declaration of interdependence. They call it that, a declaration of interdependence. It is completely at odds with our declaration of independence. Former Soviet dictator Mikhail Gorbachev and Maurice Strong, the Secretary General of the 1992 Earth Summit, say that this charter is intended, this charter, to be the new Decalogue, the new Ten Commandments. God, the creator and sustainer of the earth, of nature, of the universe, and of all things, the same God, we are to believe, is somehow ignorant and deficient when it comes to modern environmental science. But, thankfully, Mr. Gorbachev, Mr. Strong, and other UN-designated eminent persons have graciously stepped into the divine gap with a superior Ten Commandments. Actually, it's 16 commandments. They call them principles, and augmented by an additional 61 sub-principles. So leave it to the socialists to complicate the most simple. They can't even play God without unleashing the devil tree in the details. And when it comes to the Earth Charter, the devil is truly, literally, in the details. The Earth Charter declares, and I quote, "We stand at a critical moment in history, a time when humanity must choose its future," end quote. It asserts that, quote, "fundamental changes are needed in our values, institutions, and ways of living. We must undergo," it says, quote, "a change of mind and heart. And we must embark on what it calls the ongoing collaborative search for truth and wisdom." Now, why is the Earth Charter dangerous? Many of your friends and neighbors, maybe even your pastor, may read it and say, "I don't see anything terribly wrong with this. It calls for protecting the environment, for promoting democracy, guaranteeing human rights, strengthening families. It talks about values, tolerance, diversity, peace, equity, equality, sustainability. Sure, maybe it's a little fuzzy, but I don't see any reason to get worked up over it." That is precisely why it is so dangerous. The words and phraseology have been meticulously chosen as a very important exercise in linguistic deconstructionism. Deconstructionism is the revolutionary method of perverting language to subvert culture and destroy the means by which we understand and communicate facts, ideas, and truth. The average person reading the charter text will take one meaning from the words, usually the most benign meaning, completely unaware that those who crafted the text have a far different meaning in mind for the same words. The penultimate paragraph of the Earth Charter is a clarion call to empower the United Nations. It says this: in order to build a sustainable global community, the nations of the world must renew their commitment to the United Nations, fulfill their obligations under existing international agreements, and support the implementation of Earth Charter principles with an international legally binding instrument on environment and development. These objectives in this paragraph are what all of the preceding verbiage in the Charter are directed toward. The official version says the Charter can, quote, be utilized as a soft law instrument. Soft law in globalese means an important preparatory step toward later hard law, international hard law that will mandate compliance by nation states and by individuals. The Earth Charter Initiative website, you can go to it, declares this, and I quote, "The Earth Charter values and principles must be taught, contemplated, applied, and internalized. To this end, the Earth Charter needs to be incorporated into both formal and informal education. This process must involve various communities, continue to integrate the Charter into the curriculum, schools, and universities, and constitute an ongoing process of lifelong learning," unquote. It also says this: "We seek to increase the participation of young people in utilizing the Earth Charter as a guideline in their work as active agents of change," end quote. Yes, our youth are to become change agents in the scheme envisioned here. But what are they trying to change and how? Let's take a look. If you go to the Earth Charter website, www.earthcharter.org, you will see that they already have curriculum materials for this project. Many of the curricula they direct you to come from UNESCO, the United Nations Education Scientific Cultural Organization. There are many examples we could examine here, but time permits only one. The students study the sustainable lifestyles of the people of the Annapurna region of Nepal. They read an interview with Min Bahadur Gurung, a village elder, who says, quote, "Our culture and religion provide education for nature conservation. In every village, we have a forest sanctuary where we worship our forest god. The forest is prohibited from any use. Our sacred forests are set aside above our village. Our forests shape our lifestyles and behaviors. We respect the forest because it is the home of our god. We tell people not to cut down trees and not to kill animals," end quote. These curriculum materials are replete with references and examples like this that extol the supposed superior wisdom and ecological sensitivity of pantheistic indigenous spirituality and that denigrate Christianity. After reading the interviews with the tree god worshippers, the students are told, and I quote, "Identify the relevance of the 9 principles for sustainable living followed by the people in Annapurna area." And then they are told, quote, "Rate the relevance of each of the 9 principles of sustainable living to your chosen religion." Further, they are told, quote, "Summarize how people in your chosen religion do or perhaps do not practice these principles," end quote. The lesson hammered home in these lessons is that pantheistic religions inspire an ethic of living in unity and harmony with nature. Christianity, on the other hand, inspires an ethic of separateness and exploitation of nature. Pantheism is a favorite doctrine of collectivists because it offers a concept of man, which on religious grounds subordinates the individual to the collective. Since God, in this belief system, is not the transcendent personal God of the Bible, but an impersonal, immanent force that pervades all things, then all things, the universe, you, me, the rock, the tree, are all God, in a sense. In this pagan worldview, man is not a special creation of the one true God, to whom ultimately he is accountable, nor is he endowed by his creator with an immortal soul and intrinsic unalienable rights and responsibilities. Pantheism functions as an effective tool in the subversion of God-centered religion by making religion man-centered or nature-centered. And it thereby gives religious sanction to the doctrines and programs of political collectivism.